Welcome to the Wellbeing Ignites Well-Doing podcast, produced by OOT Social Health, where the focus is on exploring the essential elements that drive organizational success, human-centric leadership. Hosted by Adjoa Boahidi, principal of AKB Talent Edge.
Well-Doing podcast. My name is Tiagi Delanerol, and filling in for Adjoa K. Boahidi. I'm here with Anne-Marie Schmidt, Vice President of Human Resources and Executive Education at Smith College. Recognized for her expertise in talent pipeline development, change management, and lean continuous improvement initiatives, Anne-Marie has transformed stagnant organizations into highly engaged and thriving cultures. Welcome, Anne-Marie. So great to speak with you today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Very excited to continue this conversation with you.
So we're going to start off with a couple questions from Marcel's Proust questionnaire. Which talent would you most like to have?
To be able to listen to a song and play it on the piano. I can barely play the piano if I have music in front of me, but I am in awe of people who can do the translation from what they hear to what they're playing. I think they're very popular individuals, and I would have to say that it is a skill that I bet people who have it probably don't sufficiently appreciate it, because many of us just continue to bang out the keys and to try to convince people what song it is we are playing. It doesn't sound anything like the actual one.
You know, so I know my father, he plays the guitar, and he has that talent. He's able to listen to things and to be able to play it on the guitar. Any instrument really is just phenomenal when you're able to do that. If you were to die and were to come back as a person or thing, what would it be?
All right. I know what I'd want to be, because I've thought about this a little bit in relation to just some career and personal soul thing. I would love to come back as something that I'm not sure exists right now, but I would like to be a mirror that encourages people every day. So when you would look into this mirror, you would walk away feeling good. And I know that some people probably look in the mirror every day and say, I already feel good when I look in the mirror. But most of us are looking for things that are not quite right. And we find them, especially if you get to a certain age and you have the mirror that makes bigger. But I would love to be an encouraging mirror with thoughts of joy and encouragement, so that when people need to have that, they actually want and choose to look in that particular mirror. You know, I might end when I say it, so nobody else comes.
We'll have to figure out a way to partner on that, because I love how I have a sneaking suspicion, though, that you are that person in real life. Like, you are that mirror. I just have a feeling that when anyone comes in and speaks to you, you're likely the person that gives them, you know, really positive insights, and they walk away feeling like their cup is filled.
Well, that is very sweet and kind, and I would hope so, and I'm sure plenty to learn about doing more of that, but thank you for that comment.
At Smith College, you have driven workforce strategies aligned with changing market conditions. How do you anticipate the future of work needs and how it aligns with the organizational priorities?
I think this is one of the key questions that human resource and leaders are trying to grapple with all day, because you just continue to layer on change major disruptors like anticipation of what employees are looking for from their employer. And in my own personal experience, a number of different industries, I think the important thing to remember is that people are people. And whether it's COVID or the fact that we now have different expectations of society in general, employers are not necessarily situated to respond to what might feel to be very different asks and needs, even just 10 years ago. And so one of the areas that I try to focus on is identifying what the organizational needs will be in relation to what's being delivered to the market. Because at a point in time, certain jobs, certain roles were limited to a number of very specific industries. And those particular companies didn't have to worry about competing across all industries. We know that is the case now. Then you take the expectations around remote and flexible work, and you look at the culture. Could it be the expectation that a number of services, just fantastic services, are delivered face-to-face and have limitations on that? And finally, what I would not necessarily describe as a generational, although I think that's part of it, after coming out of COVID, I think people had a chance to reassess what's really important to them and what is expectation that employer aligns to that life balance or that attempt balance, regardless as to what phase of the employee life experience people are in.
I've looked at the research from Vivek Murthy, the former U.S. Surgeon General. He helped highlight a lot of what you're sharing in terms of the framework for wellness in the workplace. And it ties in what you're saying so that you're able to be well in order to perform well. Can you share with us what are the key steps to achieving such transformative change?
I wish it was a simple answer. And maybe in some ways, it's the most simplistic answer. But I think it comes to people valuing the dignity of others and taking the time to appreciate and understand what's important to every member of that team and every member of that organization. Now, in larger companies or institutions of higher education, that can be very difficult to do. And that's why my personal perspective, investing in leaders, managers, influencers, because many times isn't the manager who is in people, it's the individual on the team who is able to influence without authority, but truly call out what's important to people. I think that is the only way to identify and increase engagement, because it comes down to that personal alignment to mission, to values, to structure, to compensation and benefits, feeling like there is an opportunity, like you are not just showing up as that next human, but there's investment in your development. And there truly is a commitment to understand and bring together how individuals' transformation and growth opportunity simply lifts the whole organization at the same time. And what I have had the bit of witnessing, because I've worked with tremendous leaders, I have the most amazing team right now and have benefited from that in the past, is that you cannot fake caring. And so taking the time, even if you have quarter call or if things are not going well, to engage as often as possible and to ask a couple of basic questions. What obstacles can I help move? And what would make today a better day for you? Now, that sums into things that are beyond your control, but then being able to bring those items up later, and it could be the next day, it could be the next week, it could be the next month, but being able to say, you mentioned to me you have an interest in X, Y, or Z. I think project that we can incorporate you in so that you have a chance to learn. So when we describe teams that are stagnant, I think often that isn't because people choose to be stagnant, because there's a lack of engagement and that sense of caring and being valued.
Yeah, I think the big takeaway for me here, being very present, the ability to truly tap into empathy and trying to understand what's going on in their world. So change management is central to your expertise. What strategies have been most effective in navigating organizational resistance during transformations?
The whole change management component of whether it's cultural change or a new policy or a new procedure, one area, because it does take time and energy, that when we're running and running and running, everyone's just trying to execute, that can often be missed. And that isn't necessarily intentional. It's just a matter of how much energy, time, and resource do people have to be able to commit to change management. My suggestion is that it's always top of mind. And change isn't just who are we going to communicate with, what's the message, how we measure whether or not we've saturated the communication vehicles and people really understand what we're talking about. I think it's taking a step back, asking the question and answer, why are we doing this? The why is really important for a number of reasons. And I'm not saying anything particularly in my way of thinking. I think there are many individuals who probably practice this even much more than I do. But it's difficult when you're in the midst of transformation or even just asking people to do something differently, which is what AI prompt severely and very positively in my perspective.
Yeah.
And that's around declining that there are always new ways to do things and that we're not changing just for the sake of change, but we're changing to achieve something. Excuse me.
No.
And giving people opportunity to drill into the why. So we're going to be undertaking this initiative. That's why we're doing it. Well, why are we doing it? The reason we're doing it is we've assessed where we need to be in the future. But why do we have to change if things... Because what got us here won't get us there. I think within those change conversations, and you have to make the time to do it. It's like exercise. You're going to skip it. And then you're going to look back and say, oh, if I had only started 2 months ago, people would know now. So it's a marathon. It's not a sprint. Change management is the long haul. And the lesson I've learned, it's equally important to check and adjust, you know, which are a couple of lean principles, but also to admit your mistake and demonstrate that while there are some things that have to proceed in a certain direction, the how to explain the why can always be modified. And I think when leaders or project managers or whoever leading an effort or an initiative is willing to step back and say, that would actually be a better idea. You know, we're going to modify a little bit. I think that's when you start to get a sense of we're doing this for a reason, not just to change. I know that's important to me. Why I like to ask about the why. And so my assumption is if I'm going to ask about the why, I'll deserve to hear it too.
You take the time to make sure to articulate it to the team so that they're also feeling like they're on this journey with you, that you're all working towards a specific goal. Here's the critical piece is the why. How do you incorporate lean principles into workplace strategies to drive measurable improvements and build autonomous teams?
I'm going to use my version of lean, and we could certainly talk about, you know, the deadly wastes and all of those. And I have a couple I am particularly interested in. And one's context switching. And context switching, in my simple definition, which others might say that's not exactly, but it's my definition, is checking how many times a person needs to switch their focus from one thing to another, because that requires a different mindset and energy to do that. So I have been impressed and surprised, especially when joining an organization, to see how roles have sometimes developed around a person and not necessarily around a group of activities, skills, competency to be completed. And I think the person best situated to have that conversation with us is the person performing the work. The second component to that is asking, what do you think we should stop doing? Red, yellow, green light. It's very easy for me to look at a policy or now that many of us have HCM systems, human capital management systems, to say, oh, I see why we need to do all of those steps. But when I talk to someone who is in the process of working through it, they might hint out that we're doing 7 checks and rechecks that are adding up more time. I've not found very often that whoever's perfect for job hasn't just been waiting to make suggestions on improving. And I think it's important because we live in such a fast-paced world right now that people are accustomed to being able to do that outside of the workplace. And so whether you've ever ordered Uber Eats or Instacart, we're doing things in ways that put value on various steps that we're going through. So that one of my least favorite things to do is to grocery shop. And I try to do it once a month just to get in the store to see what's happening.
I'm with you.
Yeah. I thought, you know, for the period of time that I go in the store, put things in my cart, put them on that conveyor belt, put them in the bags, bring them home, unpack them. If I have those delivered to the house.
Yeah.
And, you know, hopefully support someone up to, you know, to do. Then I can use that for something different. And that's how we're wired now. And it seems to me it's only respectful and the right thing to do and actually a really smart and to talk with individuals about what are we asking you to do. It's that old proverbial situation around how people are looking at this report. Nobody. Why are we making it, creating it? And you know, you talk to the people who've been receiving it and say, I toss it or I don't even open the email. Okay, stop doing that. And what do you instead that would bring more benefit to you and to the organization?
That is such a good point. There probably was a time and place when that report was important, but things change. The companies evolve. People evolve. We have new systems, new ways of doing things. So as those changes take place, it's important for us to take time to prune, I guess, existing processes and then truly bring about efficiencies. How do you see technology transforming talent management and HR practices in the coming years?
This is what keeps me up at night, to be perfectly honest. And believe me, I have made my share of mistakes and opportunities to learn. And I try to embed those every day. Although, you know, talk to my team and my peers, I'm sure there are plenty of opportunities for improvement. The thing that is really interesting to me is that technology and human resources up until maybe the last 20 years has been back office operations. And I think when you look at an organization that has HR at the table, technology at the table, you really are focused on all of the resources, finance, people, technology. And they're getting to the point, if I look at the world, that they're almost inseparable. The reason for that is there are going to be times when you can make decisions based upon prioritization and what's available from a financial perspective, and you can reallocate where you're going to spend. If you do not have the technology that is keeping pace and allowing you to automate and to work on those things that cannot be done through repetition, then you're going to be behind everyone that you compete or that you're attempting to support from a customer perspective. Most difficult is around humans, because we each take that sort of evolution of how are we going to transform and learn different ways. And so I believe that what AI is going to do is to focus our thinking, our strategizing, our prioritization, and our conversations around repetitive work. Those things can free others up to do new and interesting. And honestly, the competency that I think rises to the top is a willingness, a determination, and a demonstration. And so as we're building out, and I found this on the technology side too, I was responsible for IT for strategy and the portfolio delivery, was that 10 years ago, we worried that if they gave their knowledge, if they transferred knowledge or documented knowledge, it would result in losing a job, in their losing the expertise and not being recognized for it. And it dawned on me in talking with many, many people that I'm going to use a very simple example here. If I'm the only one who knows how to make a particular pen, and you ask me to document the pen, and my mind says, if I tell you how to make the pen, I'm not going to have a job because you're not going to need it. It's a limited way of looking at the world, because the organization or what the leaders might do, well, if you're not going to document for us and move on thinking about something else, then we may just choose a whole different pen. So I think there is an engagement of commitment and a personal willingness and that whole evolutionary effort to have a conversation around, if my work starts to get automated, if there's something from an artificial intelligence, machine learning perspective that can weigh from me, what are you willing to invest in me so that I can focus on whatever that next wave of work is? And that's really where that commitment to learning comes from. In technology, there have been so many different languages in technology. And 15, 20 years ago, we would say you need Fortran, you need C++, whatever. I think what the insinuation and the real need was, technology changes, is a willingness to learn the newest technology. And that could be the same with a willingness to learn the new research, a willingness to learn doing something different, a willingness to expand the human contact piece, which AI perspective is at least in the short to seemingly long term, not going to be able to replace.
This is where I think HR and learning really are very much go hand in hand, especially in this era of change and AI that's emerging. We're going to move into building high performance teams. What leadership traits do you believe are most important for building and sustaining high performance teams in complex organizations?
I think the most important thing is hire people who are smarter than you and who don't get the world the same way you do, and who have skill sets that complement the objectives and the vision of the organization. And whether it's been in healthcare, energy, financial service, education, I found that the CEO or a frontline manager in a service-oriented function, feeling like you need to have all the answers and being the smartest person in the room actually is not helpful to anybody. It's not helpful to the people you hire. It's not helpful to yourself. And it certainly isn't helpful to the organization. And so we've done a lot of work around preparing our managers and our search committees to think beyond what they bring to the table. Also consider what competencies and skills are missing so that you can focus on those. Because we know that one of the biases of interviews, that conversational piece where you just feel like everything is gelling. Like, I really like this person. They're similar to me. And if you ask someone after they've done the interview, what did you like about them? They might say, well, you know, they're very outgoing. They're very engaging. I was very engaging and they're very engaging. And oh, by the way, they went to the same college I did. Or, oh, they were the same major. Or, you know, I worked at the same company they did 7-8 years ago. Which is all fine and good. But does having another person with such similarity as you help you to think beyond what you're doing today? I think that's the real challenge. And I have to say that in my current role in higher education, I honestly feel that every time I walk into the room, I'm surrounded by people who know so much more than me. And I can see the role much more clearly that I play, which is about facilitating and supporting, moving obstacles in a way that I would not have even been able to name earlier in my career. So those who are newer to leadership, I think if you can start to practice that idea of looking and saying, all right, we have 9 extroverts this team, right? Whether you're using Myers-Briggs, or you're using any other tool, or we have a whole bunch of people who are big picture, that we're all big picture and we're extroverted. Who the heck is actually going to pay attention to details, right? Because we're all out there making promises and doing this. And then people say, well, Anne-Marie, did you actually do this? And I'll say, well, I'm not a detail person, or I'm not a math person, or I'm not whatever. And there are people out there who will bring so much more than I ever in particular areas. And I think that takes a certain level of conscious leadership and servant leadership.
I love that. And you brought, like, this is actually going to tie in to the next question, because you brought up also making sure that there's like diversity in thought, right? And diversity in approaches. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, right? So inclusion is the cornerstone of thriving organizations. How do you build sustainable inclusion strategies that go beyond compliance to create lasting impact?
So I like to use the word belonging, because I think inclusion is an action that I can say, well, I included you. But matters is, does people feel belong? And that definition can be different for based upon your life experience or your expectations are at that particular moment on that particular day. So yeah. I think it starts that an organization establishes itself out there in the market. And that's why HR, from an attraction talent acquisition perspective, needs to be fully aligned with the marketing organization, because our customers can be our employees and our employees can be our customers. So if we start to bring together, you look at, and you know, again, I'll say years ago, I'm sure you could find them now, where if you look as a customer, you get one with this company or organization is like, and then if you go in and you look at the employment side, you're thinking, this doesn't really seem to match. And, you know, there's an old saying, you only treat your customers as well as you treat employees. And I think that's true. So much seamlessness in between right now that has to be aligned. So you get that message out there up front and you put people through a process that hopefully not only asks any questions about comp and benefits and mission, but really focuses on what the culture is like and the experience the person has in that interview process and when they're hired and brought on matches. So we're doing a lot of on the employee experience side to say, how much does what you understood the job to be like in the interview process actually match what you boarded to do? And now that you're in the job for 6 months, a year, 2 years, is me being the expectation. What was different? What could we do differently? What do you wish you had asked? What should we have asked? And we're sort of doing it as a stay interview. You know, that's not a new concept. Rather than exit interviews, which are sort of lagging indicators, a stay interview is checking in. What could we do different today? And I think that...
No, I haven't. So this is good. This is the first time I'm hearing it on the podcast.
All right. Well, there you go. Stay interviews, everyone. I'm happy to help anyone who wants to learn how to do.
Everyone should be doing stay interviews.
And so it is that employee experience and making sure that the experience isn't different depending upon who your manager is. Now, every human being's different. There's always going to be things that, you know, be because of the role or the work that's being done or the manager, you know, tweaked a little bit. But as far as the big pieces around feeling valued, experiencing the culture, having access to programs and services and development and all of that, we want to make sure that our managers and leaders are equipped with the information. But if there is an issue, fail safe, is that the HR partners, the HR consultants, other leaders can step in and help with that. Because my emphasis is people are truly going to be at organizations from 1 to 4 years. I want you to come back to my organization in year two or five. I want you to come back with new and different experience. I want you to feel that the relationship is not over when you leave, that we stay in touch, that we're learning more about you, and you have a place, a home, where you will be welcomed again. 15 years ago, as a recruiter, if you had not been, I'm picking on the number 15, but if you were in your job for 15 to 20 years, a recruiter might say you're 80. You know, I'm not going to bring somebody who's only been for 10 years. Now I'm congratulating you if you stayed more for 2 years. I'm like, that's great. Come and work or come back and see us. When you think that organization is going to be able to contribute to your growth down the road.
That's such a great. What are the trends and innovations you're seeing shape the future of workforce strategy and HR leadership?
So I think having a workforce strategy is critically important. And when I talk about strategy, I'm not talking about a book that sits on a shelf, because I think we've all seen where that happens. Or it could even be your, what do they call it now? When you come up with like a vision, you put the vision board up and then it's September and you say, make a lot of progress. I think the first is coming up very specific objectives that can be qualitative or quantitative that you want to work towards. So in a traditional workforce plan or workforce strategy, we're constantly referring to the aspirational goals and then applying the state of the situation. So it becomes a living document, because most organizations have limited resources, financial resources, which determines, you know, how much you can invest in technology and how many people you can hire and which skills you can afford to hire, that any time a job is vacated, the leadership, the team sit down and talk about, while it may be this job that was vacated, what jobs do we really need in the future might want to repurpose to? So it isn't me as a leader really just focused on HR or the person who's in purchasing just focusing on purchasing, or the person who has facilities just focused on a custodian, but it's basically saying, okay, maybe this job, we're going to start to a little bit. We don't have anybody who's focused on AI now. Can we repurpose dollars and that position for something that we're going to need in the future? And can we, of the work that's currently being done, can we stop doing the work that's currently being done? Or is work that's currently being done a professional development opportunity for someone who's been burning their hand and saying, give me something else to do. So I think that's a big piece. The other is being realistic about the fact that similar technology, similar to artificial intelligence, similar to all of these big waves that come through, over time, I do believe we will find locations, the right place. But at the end of the day, it will not. Again, people can watch this podcast and tell me why I was wrong in the future. Nothing is ever going to replace human interaction that will result
here.
That we have ahead to get that. Yeah. And, you know, you and I had a conversation around being in a building and opening the door for someone and just saying, hey, haven't met before, you know, what's your name? What do you know here? Let's grab a cup of coffee. You can't do that. And you can't do that with an avatar. I mean, maybe you can. Yeah. I haven't seen an avatar that really drinks coffee yet. The idea being...
And sits across from you and has a conversation and you can laugh with, truly.
Yeah. And I'm a big believer that any problem we're facing, and I think this is true for our personal lives, I think it's true for our profession, the answer, the clue is one conversation away. Our job.
I love that. That's a nugget that needs to be captured.
Sometimes I look around and I think, how does anything get accomplished at work? Because you might be coming in and you might be dealing with something at home that's absolutely traumatizing. You might be coming in with financial issues and that's all that you're thinking about. You might be coming in with a health challenge. But something in that human interaction allows us to put all of that aside, at least for a few minutes, and focus on something together. That's what actually helps us the next day. And to come back and try again. And try again. That doesn't minimize in any way, shape, or form saying that those things we describe don't sort of act as a pallor over things happening. Mm-hmm. But when my situation might be a little bit more stable and someone comes in with an issue, I need to take that discretionary energy and help. And I've had so many people do the same for me. Those are the types of comments, human centric. Being human.
Very last question. If you were to be able to give yourself, your 20-year-old self, Anne Marie, right, a piece of advice, what would it be?
That's such a good question. And I'm thinking of a couple of different things. I'm thinking about the fact that I would say, this might be in my talking mirror, right? Let's just remember the talking mirror piece.
Exactly.
It would be that you and everyone you encounter has dignity, will find your path, and you do not have to have the answers. It will be okay. And that at the end of the day, we learn more about ourselves and I think self-actualize and contribute in ways that I believe we're all wired to want with other people right by our side and with us on the side of other people. That's what I would say. And don't those clothes that are going on a style will be back. So keep them in the back closet.
Love that. Thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it on behalf of the Employee Wellbeing Council.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you for joining us on the Wellbeing Ignites Well Doing podcast, brought to you by OOT Social Health. We hope today's conversation has sparked new insights and inspired you to prioritize well-being in your journey to organizational success. Remember, when well-being ignites, well-doing follows. Stay tuned for more episodes as we continue to explore the power of human-centric leadership. Until then, be well, and lead with purpose.